Track 17.
The army stagnated for days in the camp below the escarpment, while their sheikh lay sequestered in his tent. Under Bashir's direction, they gathered in the wounded and built thatched shelters for them beneath the shade trees. Ben Abram tended them. They buried their dead, but left undisturbed those who were already interred beneath the red rock of the avalanche. They repaired the smashed equipment and resharpened their weapons. Then they waited for further orders. None came. Bashir al-Sindh strode angrily through the camp, lashing out at any man who crossed his path, and the men shared his frustration. They burned for a chance to avenge their comrades, who had died in the narrows of the pass, but they could not move without the orders of al-Salil. Ugly rumours spread through the camp that Bashir would rebel and take over command from the ailing sheikh, that the sheikh had died, that he had recovered, that he had sneaked away in the night and left them to their fate. Then another stranger rumour flared through the ranks, that a second grand expeditionary force, under the command of a prince of the royal house of Oman, was marching up from the coast to join them. With this combined force, they would be allowed at last to pursue the infidel into his lair. This rumour was only hours old when they heard the low thump of distant war drums, at first so soft that it seemed to be the beating of their own hearts. The Arab soldiers crowded the high ground to look out across the plain and thrilled to the blast of a ram's horn trumpet. They saw a splendid host approaching, with a staff of high-ranking officers riding at the head. They gathered in awe as these strangers rode into the camp. The officer who led the cohorts wore half-armour in the Turkish style, with pot-shaped helmets, spiked on top, and with a padded neck flap. From the back of his horse, this splendid figure addressed them in ringing tones. "I am Prince Ibn al-Malik Abu Bakr. Men of Oman, loyal soldiers and true, I bring you sad tidings. Abd Muhammad al-Malik, my father and your caliph, is dead in the Muscat Palace, struck down in his prime by the sword of the Black Angel." A groan went up from the ranks, for most of them had fought at Muscat to place al-Malik on the elephant throne, and they had loved their caliph. They threw themselves down on their knees and cried out, "May God have mercy on his soul!" Abu Bakr let them give expression to their sorrow, then he held up a gloved hand for their silence. "Soldiers of the Caliph, I bring you salutations from your new ruler, Zayn al-Din, beloved elder son of al-Malik, who is now the Caliph. He bids me call you to swear allegiance and loyalty to him." They knelt in rows, with Bashir al-Sindh at the head of the army, and swore the oath of fealty, calling on God to witness it. By the time the ceremony was over, the sun was setting. Then Abu Bakr dismissed them and called Bashir to him. "Where is that coward and traitor, al-Salil?" he demanded. "On behalf of the Caliph, I have urgent business with him." Dorian heard the pronouncement of his adoptive father's death while he lay on the sleeping mat in his tent, for Abu Bakr's voice carried clearly through the leather sidewall. It seemed that all the foundations of his life were being torn out one at a time. He felt too weak and sick to surmount these shocks and hardships. Then he heard Zayn al-Din's name and the news of his accession to the elephant throne, and realized that his predicament was even worse than he had fancied. With a vast effort, he put aside his sorrow for his father and his own debilitating physical suffering, took Yasmini's hand and drew her closer to his bed. She was shaken by the news of al-Malik's death, but not as deeply as Dorian, for she had hardly known her father as a man. She recovered from her sorrow swiftly when he shook her. "We're in great danger, Yasi. Now we are both completely in Zayn's power. I do not have to tell you what that means, for Kush was a saint in comparison to our brother. But how can we escape him? For you cannot move, Dawi. What can we do?" He told her what she must do for them, speaking softly and urgently, making her repeat every detail. "I would give you a written letter, but I cannot write with this arm. You must carry my message by word of mouth alone, but learn it well, for otherwise it will not be believed." She was quick-witted, and even in her confused state she memorized it all perfectly at the first attempt, although she had difficulty in enunciating some of the words he taught her. There was no time for her to perfect them. "That'll do. He'll understand. Now, go," he ordered her.
"I cannot leave you, Lord," she pleaded.
"Abu Bakr will recognize you if you stay by me. In his clutches you will be no help to either of us." She kissed him once, tenderly and lovingly, then rose to leave him. But there came a heavy tramp outside the tent, and she shrank back into a corner, covered her head and shoulders with her shawl. At that moment the tent flap was thrown open, and Bashir al-Sindh stepped in. Ben Abram tried to intervene and prevent him approaching the bed on which Dorian lay.
"Al-Salil is sorely wounded and must not be disturbed."
Bashir pushed him aside contemptuously.
"General Abu Bakr, the emissary of the Caliph, approaches," he warned Dorian, and his expression was cold and malicious.
Dorian knew that he had changed allegiance and was no longer his loyal friend and ally. Behind him, Abu Bakr stepped into the tent and stood with his hands on his hips.
"So, the traitor yet lives. That is good. Al-Salil, who was once Al-Amhara in the Zenana at Lamu, where we were playmates," he sniggered sarcastically. "I have come to take you to the Caliph to answer capital charges of treason. We will march for the coast tomorrow at dawn."
Ben Abram intervened again.
"Noble prince, he cannot be moved. His wound is grievous. It will endanger his very life."
Abu Bakr stepped close to the bed and looked down at Dorian.
"A wound, you say? How can I be certain he is not shirking?"
Suddenly he reached down and grasped the padded dressing that covered Dorian's chest. With one brutal gesture he ripped it away. The fresh-formed scab was stuck to the bandage, and as it came away, Dorian stiffened and hissed with agony. Fresh blood started from the wound and trickled down his chest. In the corner of the tent, Yasmini whimpered with sympathy, but none of them took notice of her.
"It is but a mere scratch,"
Abu Bakr gave his opinion as he pretended to examine the open wound. "Not enough to keep a traitor from justice." He grabbed a handful of Dorian's thick red hair and dragged him from the bed.
"Get on your feet, traitor pig."
He pulled Dorian upright.
"See, doctor, how strong is your patient? He has been duping you. There is little wrong with him."
"Noble prince, he will not survive such treatment, or the long march to the coast."
"Ben Abram, you doddering old goat, if he dies before we reach the coast, I will have your head. Let it be a contest between you and me."
He smiled and showed all his uneven teeth.
"You must do your best to keep Al-Salil alive. For my part, I will do my best to kill him by degrees. We shall see who wins."
He threw Dorian back onto his sleeping mat and turned to stride out of the tent. Bashir followed him. Yasmini sprang up and rushed to Dorian. Although his face was contorted with agony, he whispered to her fiercely,
"Go, woman. Waste not another moment. Find Batula and ride."
Tom and his band reached Fort Providence in 3 days of hard riding and immediately started to make preparations to abandon the settlement. Abali sent Fundi and 3 of his men upriver to fetch his family.
"I cannot sail without them," he told Tom simply.
"I would not expect that," Tom replied. "But they must make haste. We can be sure the musclemen are hard on our tracks." Tom sent out pickets to cover all the approaches to the fort, so that they would have warning when the Arab forces appeared. Then, in haste, they began to load the Centaurus for her departure down the Lunga River. They fetched the light 9-pounder cannon from the emplacements on the stockade wall and placed them in their carriages on the upper deck. There was no ivory to take with them, but they reloaded all the trade goods they had brought up from Good Hope at the beginning of the season. Sarah gathered all her treasures and brought them aboard, the linen and cutlery, pots and pans, medical stores and books, almost filling their tiny cabin. Tom argued about the harpsichord.
"I'll buy you another," he promised.
But when he saw that peculiar expression of hers, he knew he was wasting his breath. With poor grace, he allowed 2 seamen to carry it up the gangplank and sway it down into the hold. It was strange, but still there was no sign of pursuit from the north. and Tom sent out Abberley to make certain that the pickets covering the northern trails were alert and at their posts. This calm was unnatural. Surely retribution must come soon. The days passed. Then, at last, Fundy returned downriver from Lotsiland with two dugout canoes carrying Zeti and Fala, the two boys Zama and Tula, and the new babies. Sarah took them all under her wing. Tom sent an urgent messenger after Abberley, bidding him bring in the pickets, for all was at last in readiness for the departure. 2 days later, there was a shout from the sentry on the watchtower above the fort. "Riders, coming from the north!" Tom climbed up the ladder, telescope in hand. "Where away?" he demanded, and when the sentry pointed, he focused the telescope. Sarah climbed up to the top of the tower beside him. "Who is it?" she asked anxiously. "It's Abberley, bringing in the pickets." He whistled softly with relief and satisfaction. "And no sign of pursuit. It looks as though we might get clear away without a fight. I had not thought that possible. I cannot understand why the musselmen have let us off so lightly. Get all your little brats on board. We will shove off downriver as soon as Abberley steps on deck." She started down the ladder, but he stopped her with another whistle. "Abberley is bringing in two strangers. Arabs, by God. Prisoners, by the look of it. For Abberley has them well trussed up. He has bagged himself a couple of enemy scouts. Like as not, they will be able to tell us where their main force is." Tom and Sarah were waiting for them when Abberley marched his captives aboard the Centaurus. "What fine fish are these you have netted, Abberley?" Tom asked, as he eyed them. "By their apparel they were Arabs, one a warrior, and a dangerous one by the look of him. The other was a slip of a boy, a pretty lad with big dark eyes, who was timid and fearful." "An unlikely pair," Tom said. The boy seemed encouraged by his easy tone. "Effendi, you speak my language?" he asked softly, and his voice was sweet and unbroken. "Yes, boy, I speak Arabic." "Your name is Tom." "Damn you, you little scamp!" Tom frowned and stepped towards him threateningly. "How did you know that?" "Tom, wait!" Sarah stopped him. "She is a girl." Tom stared hard into Yasmini's face, then laughed. He snatched off her headcloth, and her long dark hair tumbled around her shoulders. "So she is. And a mighty pretty one, too. Who are you?"
"I am the Princess Yasmini, and I bring you a message from Dowie."
"From who?"
"From Dowie."
She looked desperate.
"Dowie! Dowie!"
She repeated it with different inflections, but Tom shook his head, puzzled.
"I think she's trying to say Dory,"
Sarah intervened, and relief rushed across Yasmini's face.
"Yes, yes, Dowie. Dowie, your brother."
Tom's face turned ugly, swelling with dark blood. "You come here to mock me. My brother Dory has been dead these many years. What are you playing at, you little bitch? Is this a trap?" he shouted into her face. Her eyes welled with tears, but she drew herself up and began to sing. Her voice was hesitant at first, but then it steadied, became sweet and true. But she sang in the semi-quavers of the Orient, alien to the European ear. The tune was twisted and the words were a parody of the English language. They all stared at her in total incomprehension. Then Sarah gasped, "Tom, it's Spanish ladies. She's trying to sing Spanish ladies." She rushed forward and embraced Yasmini. "It must be true. Dorian is alive, and the song is his sign that this girl comes from him." "Dorian? Is it possible? Where is he?" Tom grabbed one of Yasmini's arms and shook it violently. "Where is my brother?" It came out in a garbled rush of words. Yasmini started another sentence before she had finished the one that preceded it, tripping over her tongue in her haste to tell it all, and leaving much out, so that she had to go back and start again. "Dory needs help." Tom picked out the essentials and turned to Abberley. "Dory is alive and in dire straits and has sent them to fetch us." "The horses are still saddled," Abberley said calmly. "We can ride at once." Tom turned back to Yasmini, who was still gabbling out her story to Sarah. "Enough, girl," he stopped her. There'll be time later to tell the rest of it. Can you take us to Dorry?
Yes, she said vehemently. Batula and I can lead you to him.
Tom leaned down from the saddle to give Sarah a final hasty kiss. For once she had not insisted on accompanying this expedition. Tom should have realized by this unusual behavior and by her recent reticence that something was afoot, but he was so distracted that he gave it not a thought. Make sure Alf Wilson keeps everyone aboard and all secure. When we return, we will be in great haste, like as not with half of Araby hard on our heels. He gathered the reins, lifted his horse's head, and looked around for the others. Yasmini and Batula had already started and were halfway up the first hill above the Lunga River. Luke and Abeli were hanging back, waiting for Tom to catch up with them. Everyone was dressed in Arab robes and led a spare horse on a rein. Tom clapped his heels into his horse's flanks and waved back at Sarah as it bounded forward under him. "Come back soon and safe," Sarah called after him, with one hand pressed lightly to her stomach. It had taken them 4 days, riding hard, changing horses every hour, using every glimmer of light from dawn to the brief African dusk, to catch up with the Arab column. Tom had ridden beside Yasmini all the way, and they had talked until their throats were dry with the dust and the heat. She had told him everything that had happened to Dorian since she had first met him in the Zenana until his arrest by Abu Bakr only days before. This time her story was coherent and lucid, touched with humour and pathos, so at times Tom laughed with delight and at others was moved to the brink of tears. She showed him what type of man Dorian had become and made Tom proud. She told him of her and Dorian's love for each other and in the process won Tom's affection and liking. He was enchanted by her pretty sparkle and her sunny nature. "So now you will be my little sister," he smiled at her fondly. "I like that, Effendi," she smiled back. "It makes me very happy." "If I am to be your brother, you must call me Tom." When she reminded him of the fight in the pass and explained how he had cut down his own brother, nearly run her through too, he was smitten with remorse. "He never showed his face. How could I know?" "He understands, Tom. He loves you still. I might have killed both of you. It was as though something outside me held my hand. God's ways are marvellous, and not for us to question." She led him through the complicated maze of royal Omani politics, explained how they had been caught up in them, and the consequences to Dorian of Zayn al-Din's accession to the caliphate. "So now Abu Bakr takes him back to Muscat to face the spite and vengeance of Zayn," she said, and the tears ran down her dusty face. He leaned across and patted her arm like a brother. "We will see to that, Yasmini. Please do not weep." They cut the wide, deep spoor of the marching Arab army and closed in on it until they could make out the dust cloud above the forest. Then Batula went ahead, while the rest hung back and waited until night fell. He would be able to infiltrate the loose mass of veiled riders without drawing attention or suspicion. Just as the sun was setting, he returned along the back trail.
"Praise God! Al-Salil is still alive," were his first words. To Tom, the use of Dorian's Arab name still sounded strange. "I have seen him from afar, but did not try to reach him. They bear him on a drag litter behind a horse." "How strong did he seem?" Tom demanded.
"He can walk a little," Batula replied. "I saw Ben Abram help him from the litter and lead him to the tent where they have him now. His right arm is still in a sling. He moves slowly, stiffly, like an old man, but he carries his head high. He is stronger than when we left him."
"Praise God's name," whispered Yasmini.
"Can you lead us to his tent, Batula?" Tom asked. Batula nodded. "Yes, but they guard him well."
"Have they put chains on him?"
"No, Effendi. They must consider his wound enough restraint."
"We will bring him out this very night," Tom decided. "And this is how we will do it."
They approached the camp from upwind, so that their horses would not smell those of the Arabs and whinny to them. They left Yasmini to hold them and went forward to the edge of the forest. The camp was as murmurous as a beehive, and the air was blue and thick with the smoke of hundreds of cooking fires. There was constant movement, grooms and slaves coming and going from the horse lines, men drifting into the surrounding bush on personal business and returning to their sleeping mats, the cooks bearing steaming rice pots through the camp and doling out the evening meal. Few sentries were set, and little order enforced.
"Abu Bakr is not a real soldier," Batula said contemptuously. "Al-Salil would never allow such a lack of discipline."
Tom sent Batula into the camp first, and the rest followed him singly at intervals, moving casually, veiled and robed with their weapons concealed. Batula went towards a hollow in the centre of the encampment, where a leather tent had been set up in isolation from the others. In the firelight, Tom saw that the scrub around it had not been cleared, but that at least three guards were posted around it. They squatted with their weapons across their laps. Batula settled down under a twisting branched marula tree, 100 yards from the prison tent. The others came up casually and joined him, squatting in a circle and spreading their robes around them, until, in the semi-darkness, they seemed like any of the other small groups of Omani soldiers scattered about, talking softly, drinking coffee, and sharing a pipe. Suddenly there was a stir as a group of three splendidly apparelled Arabs came striding towards them, followed closely by their bodyguards. Tom felt a flutter of panic, certain that somehow their presence had been discovered, but the men passed close by them and went on towards the tent.
"He with the blue headcloth and gold rope is Prince Abu Bakr, the one I told you of," whispered Batula. "The other two are Al-Sint and Bintati, both fierce soldiers and liegemen of Abu Bakr."
Tom watched the three enter the tent in which Dorian lay prisoner. They were close enough to hear the murmur of voices from behind the leather walls. Then came the sound of a blow and a cry of pain. Tom half rose to his feet, but Abali reached out a hand and drew him down. There was more talking within the tent. Then Abu Bakr stooped out through the fly and paused to look back.
"Keep him alive, Ben Abram, that he may die with more passion."
Abu Bakr laughed and came back, passing so close that Tom could have touched the hem of his robe.
"Salaam alaikum, mighty lord," Tom murmured.
But Abu Bakr never glanced in his direction and went on to where his own tent stood in the centre of the encampment. Slowly a hush settled. The voices died away, men curled up in their shawls around the fires, and the flames burned down to ash. Tom and his men lay down around the small fire Batula had built and covered their heads, but did not sleep. As the fires died, the darkness deepened. Tom watched the stars to judge the passage of time. It went infinitely slowly. At last he reached across and touched Abali's back.
"It is time."
He stood up slowly and moved towards Dorian's tent. He had been watching the sentry who sat at the rear. He had seen his head droop, then come up with a jerk, only to droop again. Tom walked up softly behind him, leaned over him, and struck him across the temple with the barrel of his pistol. He felt the thin bone break, and the man sagged forward without a sound. Tom squatted in his place, assuming the same position with the man's musket across his lap. He waited for a long minute to make certain that there was no alarm. Then he eased himself forward on his haunches until he was close to the rear wall of the tent. He had no way of knowing if they had posted a guard inside the tent at Dorian's bedside. He wet his lips, drew breath, then softly whistled the opening bar of Spanish Ladies. Someone stirred behind the leather wall, and then came a voice he did not remember. It was not like the voice of the child Dorian when they had parted. It was the voice of a man.
"Tom?" "Aye, lad. Is it safe within?" "Only Ben Abram and me."
Tom slipped out his jackknife, and the leather wall of the tent fell apart beneath the blade. A hand reached out to him through the gap, pale in the starlight. Tom seized it, squeezed hard, and Dorian drew him through the gap into the tent where they embraced, kneeling chest to chest. Tom started to speak, but his voice was choked. He hugged Dorian with all his strength, and drew another breath.
God love you, Dorian Courtney. I know not what to say. Tom!
Dorian reached up with his good hand and seized a handful of the thick, dust-stiff curls at the back of his brother's head.
It's so good to see you.
The English words were alien on his tongue, and he was weeping, overwhelmed by the weakness of his wound and by a towering joy.
Don't do that, Dorry, or you'll set me off,
Tom protested, and pulled away to wipe his eyes on the back of his arm.
Let's get you out of here, lad. How badly are you hurt? Can you walk if Uberly and I help you? Uberly, is he here with you?
Dorian's voice trembled.
I am here, Bon Vu,
Uberly rumbled beside his ear. But there will be time for all this later. He had dragged in the fallen sentry through the cut in the tent wall. Now Tom and he rolled the Arab onto the sleeping mat and covered his body with Dorian's woolen blanket. In the meantime, Ben Abram was helping Dorian into his robe, covering those shining red curls with a turban.
Go with God, Al-Salil, he whispered, and turned to Tom. I am Ben Abram. Do you remember me?
I shall never forget you and your kindness to my brother, old friend. Tom gripped his arm.
All God's blessings be upon you. You have kept your oath, Ben Abram said softly. Now you must gag and bind me, else Abu Bakr will treat me cruelly when he finds Al-Salil gone.
They left Ben Abram trussed up and took Dorian through the back wall. Outside the tent, they lifted him to his feet and supported him between them. Then they started slowly through the sleeping camp. Batula and Luke Jarvis went ahead, moving like dark ghosts, and they skirted one of the campfires. A sleeping Arab stirred, sat up, and stared at them as they passed close to where he lay, but let them go unchallenged, sank down to the earth again, and covered his head again.
Bear up, Dorry,
Tom whispered in his ear.
Nearly out of it.
They went on towards the edge of the forest, and as the trees closed around them, Tom almost exclaimed aloud with relief. But at that moment a harsh voice challenged them in Arabic from close at hand.
What manner of men are you? Stand in God's name and deliver yourselves.
Tom reached for the sword under his robe, but Dorian caught his hand and replied in the same language.
The peace of Allah on you, friend. I am Mustafa of Muhaid, and I am devoured by the dysentery. My friends take me to a private place in the bush.
Oh, you are not alone in your suffering, Mustafa. There is much of the sickness in the camp,
the sentry sympathized.
Peace upon you, and on your bowels also.
They moved on slowly. Suddenly Batula appeared again out of the night.
This way, Effendi, he whispered. The horses are close.
They heard the stamp of a hoof. And suddenly Yasmini's small figure detached itself from the darkness and raced to Dorian. They clung to each other, exchanging embraces and soft, loving whispers, until Tom drew them gently apart and led Dorian to the strongest horse. Between them, Aberley and Tom boosted him into the saddle, where he swayed unsteadily. Tom tied his ankles together with a leather thong stretched under the horse's belly, and they swung Yasmini up behind him.
"Hold him steady, little sister," Tom told him. Do not let him slide off.
He mounted his own horse and took the lead rein of Dorian's mount.
Take us home, Aberley, he said, and looked back through the trees towards the sleeping camp. We will not have more than a few hours' start at best. Then they will be after us like a swarm of hornets. They used the horses cruelly. The animals had been driven hard on the ride up from Fort Providence, given almost no rest and time to graze, except during the brief night halts. Now the treatment was the same on the ride back. It was baking hot at noon, and the stretches between water were long. The hard ground and flinty stones ripped into the animals' hoofs. They lost the first horse before they'd gone 20 miles. It was the mount carrying Dorian and Yasmini. It went stone lame in all four hoofs and could barely hobble. Tom turned it loose, knowing in his heart that lions and hyena would have the brave beast that same night. They put Dorian up on one of the spares and went on at the same pace. By the third day they had burned up all the spare horses
and had only those they rode. As they were about to mount again after the brief noon stop at a muddy waterhole, Abeli said quietly, "The muskets will be no use to us against an army, and the weight is killing the horses." They abandoned their firearms and powder flasks, shot bags, and every stick of baggage, keeping only their edged weapons and the water skins. Tom turned his back so that none would see what he did, and slipped one of the loaded pistols into his belt below his shirt. It was a double-barreled weapon. He knew from what Yasmini had told him of the fate that awaited her and Dorian if the Arabs caught up with them. The pistol was for them, one barrel each. "God, give me the strength to do it when the time comes," he prayed silently. Though they had drastically lightened the load, they lost another two horses that day. Luke, Abeli, and Tom took turns trotting beside the mounted men, hanging on to the stirrup leathers to keep up with the driving pace of the march. That evening, for the first time, they spotted the pursuing column of Arabs. They were crossing another line of those hills that ran with the grain of this wild country. When they looked back, they saw the dust cloud rising 3 leagues behind them. That night they stopped only for an hour, then went on by starlight, following the high beacon of the Great Cross in the constellation of Centaurus. Despite this long night march, and that the Arabs must be burning up their mounts even as they were, they discovered when the dawn broke that they had gained no ground on the pursuit. In the early sunlight, the dust cloud rose red as blood on the horizon, still 3 leagues behind them. During the night marches, even Abeli had lost all sense of distance covered and their exact position in this wilderness of forest and broken hilly country. That evening they crossed another line of hills, hoping to see the shining waters of the Lunga below them, but their hopes were dashed as ahead rose yet another line of green hills. They struggled across the intervening valley, the horses almost finished, and all of them nearing the limit of their endurance. Even Abeli was suffering, trying to conceal the limp caused by a strained ligament in his knee. His face was dry and dusty grey, with all the moisture sweated out of him. Dorian was gaunt, his body skeletal beneath his robe, his wound weeping fresh blood from under the filthy dressing. Yasmini had almost exhausted the last of her strength, trying to hold him in the saddle. The last horse staggered under their combined weight. It fell just below the crest of the hills, going down as though it had taken a musket ball through the brain. Tom cut the thong that held Dorian's ankles together and dragged him out from under it. "It's Shanks's pony from here, lad. Can you go on?" he asked him. Dorian tried to smile. "I can go on as long as you can, Tom." But when Tom tried to lift him, his knees gave way under him, and he sagged to the stony ground. Close behind them, the red dust cloud rose in the valley they had just crossed. They cut a short pole, and Abeli and Tom took the ends. They sat Dorian in the middle of it, placing his arms around their shoulders, and staggered down the side of the hill into the valley, carrying him between them. They stopped during the night for a few minutes at a time, then picked up Dorian on his pole and carried him forward until they could not take another pace and sagged to the ground for another rest. It took them all that night to cross the wide valley. They could only hope that the pursuit had halted in the dark behind them, unable to follow their spoor. Dawn caught them toiling up the slope on the far side of the valley. When they looked back, the Arabs were so close that their lance tips caught the early light and twinkled merrily. "They've halved the distance," Tom gasped, as they lowered Dorian to the ground for another rest. "At the speed we are making, they will be up to us in an hour." "Leave me here, Tom," Dorian whispered. "Save yourselves." "You are mad," Tom cried. "The last time I turned my back on you, you were gone for years. I'll not take that risk again." They hoisted him and set off again. Yasmini was walking a few paces ahead. Her leather sandals were ripped and torn almost off her feet, and her heels were bleeding where the blisters had burst open. She fell before they reached the crest, and though she crawled to the nearest tree and tried to use the trunk to pull herself upright, she was too weak to regain her feet. "Luke, take my place here. You, Batula, help him." "Tom,
handed over the end of the carrying pole to them, and went to where Yasmini crouched against the tree, sobbing softly.
"I am a stupid, weak woman," she wept, as he stooped over her.
"Yes," he agreed, "but much too pretty to leave behind." He lifted her, and though she was fragile and bird-like, the effort strained every sinew and muscle in his aching back and shoulders. He held her to his chest and braced himself to take another step upwards. There was a faint shout far behind them, and he looked back over his shoulder. The outriders of the Arab pursuit column had reached the foot of the hill below them. One raised his jezel, and powder smoke spurted from the long barrel. Seconds later they heard the thud of the shot, but the range was still too long, and the ball came nowhere near them.
"Almost at the top," Tom sang out, trying to sound cheerful and gay. "One more tilt at it, lads."
He stepped out on the top of the hill, blinded by sweat. He knew he could go no further. He lowered Yasmini to the ground and wiped his eyes, but his vision was still blurred and starred with bright lights. He reeled on his feet, looked back at the others, and saw that they too were finished. Even Ubberly had used up the last of his giant strength. He could hardly take the last few steps onto the crest. "This is where we'll die," Tom thought. "I still have the blue sword to make a decent fight of it. And in the end I will have the pistol for Yasmini and Dorian." He fumbled under his shirt and touched the butt. Then, suddenly, Ubberly was beside him, shaking his arm, unable to speak, pointing down into the valley ahead. For a moment, Tom thought it must be a mirage, but then he realized that the dazzle that hurt his squinting eyes was the sunlight off the wide surface of the Lunga River, and that the little Centaurus was moored against the bank. They were so close that they could see tiny human figures on the open deck. Tom felt new strength flow into his legs. He drew the pistol from under his shirt and fired both barrels in the air. There was a sudden stir on the ship, and Tom saw the flash of a telescope lens as it was aimed up at them. He waved wildly, and the tall figure of Alf Wilson waved back. Tom turned and looked behind him. The Arab outriders were coming on at a gallop, already halfway up the hill. Without another word, Tom picked up Yasmini and launched himself down the slope towards the river. Gravity took hold of his legs, and he could hardly keep up with them. Each pounding step jarred his spine as the ground flew past under his feet. He heard Ubberly and the others coming down after him, but he could not look back. It took all his wits and strength to stay on his feet. Yasmini closed her eyes in fear and clung to him with both arms around his neck. Suddenly there was a shout from behind them and a volley of musket fire. The Arabs had reached the top of the hill. A musket ball knocked a slab of bark and a burst of wet white splinters from the bole of the tree close beside Tom. He could not keep up the pace, and with Yasmini's weight he could not stop. He felt one of his legs give way under him, and he fell. He and the girl rolled in a tangle together until they slid into a boulder and lay stunned. Ubberly came past them, with Dorian on his back, bouncing and staggering, Batula and Luke Jarvis trying to keep up with him. Ubberly's legs were beyond his control. He could not stop to help Tom, but Luke grabbed Tom's arm and dragged him up, while Batula lifted Yasmini in his arms and took a few more unsteady paces down the hill. There was a rumble of hoofs as the Arabs charged their mounts down upon them. They had already couched their lances, and Tom could see the expressions of triumph on their dark faces. Then he heard Sarah shout his name, "Tom, we're coming!" He spun around and saw that she was astride a bay, dragging two spare horses on lead reins behind her, coming straight up the hill at full pelt. Alf Wilson was a length behind her, on a black mare from their herd. He also had two spares. Sarah reined in beside him, and Tom snatched Yasmini out of Batula's arms and almost threw her light body over the withers of Sarah's mount. Sarah grabbed her and prevented her from slipping over the other side of the horse.
"Go!" Tom gasped. "Get her out of here!"
Sarah said not a word, but tossed him the reins of the spare horses and wheeled away down the hill with Yasmini bumping like a wet sack before her. Tom left one horse for Luke and Batula and threw himself onto the back of the other. He caught up with Ubberly swiftly and plucked Dorian's bleeding, battered body off his back.
"Take a mount from Alf,"
he shouted at Abeli as he swept past and tore down the hill after Sarah. He heard Arabic howls and driving hooves close behind him, and expected a lance thrust into his back at any instant. But he could not spare a backward glance. He was too busy clutching Dorian. In despair, he felt him slip from his grasp and could not hold him. Then suddenly, Abeli was riding beside him. He leaned across and pushed Dorian upright so that Tom could get a fresh grip around his shoulders. When they hit the level ground of the riverbank, Tom and Abeli were riding knee to knee, hard behind Sarah, who still held Yasmini. Next came Alf, Batula, and Luke in a group. Close behind charged the Arab cavalry. They were gaining, reaching forward eagerly with the long lances. Sarah did not hesitate when she reached the river. She pushed her mount straight on. It leapt out from the high bank, then hit the water in a burst of spray and went clean under. Tom and Abeli followed her over the edge without checking their gallop. Then the others jumped almost on top of them. They came up, swimming beside their straining mounts, heading out into the stream towards where the Centaurus lay. Behind them, the Arabs reined up on the bank in a swirl, trying to draw their jezils out of their boots as their horses reared and plunged. The first blast of grape shot from one of the Centaurus's 9-pounders caught them, and half went down in a bloody, broken tangle of men and animals. The rest wheeled away in panic and tore back up the hill as another broadside from the Centaurus shattered the trees around them. The swimming horses reached the ship's side, and the seamen dragged the riders on board. As soon as he reached the deck, Tom ran straight to Sarah, and the two embraced, with water streaming from their hair and sodden clothing. "In a fix, you are worth 10 men to me, my beauty." Then he pulled back from her. "Dorian is sore hurt. He will need all your care. Yasmini is done in also. Look to them while I get the ship away." He strode to the helm and glanced up at the rigging. Alf Wilson had everything shipshape and ready. "If you please, Mr. Wilson, will you get us underway downriver?" Tom ordered, then sought out Abeli. "We're going to need the horses to drag the ship through the shallows. Take them down to the south bank on the far side of the river from the musselman. You should be able to keep pace with the ship." Abeli called to his sons Zama and Tula. "Now I have a man's work for you. Come with me." They followed him over the ship's side to help round up the herd. Tom felt the ship come alive under his feet and swing out into the current. The banks started to stream past on either hand. He looked to the south bank and saw that Abeli and his boys had the horses gathered into a compact herd and were bringing them along the bank at a canter. He swung round and looked to the north, just in time to see the vanguard of the main Arab army coming over the crest and start down towards the river in a solid stream of glittering armour, lances and musket barrels. Tom snatched the telescope from Alf Wilson's hand and focused it on the head of the advancing column. He picked out Abu Bakr's Turkish helmet and Al-Sint's yellow turban riding beside him. "I think we will have an honour guard all the way downriver," he told Alf grimly. "They won't be able to trouble us much until we reach the shallows." Before they reached the sea, they would have to negotiate the shallows, where the river spread out and slowed its plunge towards the ocean. Here the sandbars were always changing depth and position. With the present height of the water, there would be barely enough to float the Centaurus through. He could expect Abu Bakr and Al-Sind to follow them down and harass them all the way. Tom had only hours before they reached this treacherous stretch, and he set all hands to making the preparations for warping the ship over the bars and for defending her from enemy attack while she was most vulnerable. He seized a moment to visit the cabin where Sarah had taken Dorian and Yasmini. With relief, he found his brother resting easily in the little bunk. Sarah had changed the dressing on his wound, and she nodded at Tom to let him know all was well. Yasmini had recovered enough to help her, and she was feeding Dorian from a pewter bowl of soup. Tom spent only a minute with them before he hurried on deck again. The first thing he saw as he stepped over the combing was the long column of Omani cavalry streaming down the north bank after them. 500 or more, he estimated, and Alf Wilson agreed.
Enough to do us some mischief in a straight fight, Captain. We'd best not let it come to that.
Tom smiled with more confidence than he felt. How long before we reach the shallows?
Oh, 2 hours at this speed.
Right, then. We're going to lighten the ship. Throw everything overboard that is not essential to our voyage, he ordered. Then he lowered his voice so that it would not carry to Sarah in the cabin below.
You can start with the harpsichord.
With splash after high splash, they jettisoned the cargo. After the harpsichord, they sent over the bales of trade goods, left them bobbing in the wake as they bore down swiftly on the sandbars. Most of the powder kegs went over the side, and all the iron roundshot. Tom kept just enough powder and grape to fight during an hour of heavy engagement. Drain half the water from the barrels. Leave just enough to allow us to reach Good Hope on short rations, Tom cried. That would be a terrible hardship for the women and children. But capture by the Omani would be a lot worse, he consoled himself. While the crew worked, Tom kept an eye on the following cavalry. Where the current sped through the narrows, the Centaurus pulled ahead of the Omani column, but when it slowed up and the wind became fluky in the middle of the day, the sails flapped lazily and the Arabs regained all the ground they had lost. Tom loaded one of the stern cannon with a double charge of powder and a hatful of grape shot. When the head of the column came within extreme range, he fired at it. He did little damage, but the horses bucked and danced, and the Arabs fell back respectfully. Abeli and the two boys leading the horses on the south bank were keeping up well. Their herd was rested and strong, while the Arab mounts had been worn down by the long pursuit and could not match them. They came down a last shoot of racing water, steering the wooden hull between outcrops of ugly black rock. Then all the speed and power went out of the current, and they idled down to where the sandbanks almost choked off the river with their yellow humps of gravel. "Get the women and children into the longboats," Tom ordered. "Every pound of weight will make a difference to our draft." Dorian was too weak to be sent ashore, and Yasmini stayed to take care of him. Sarah took the helm to free a man from the heavy work of warping. All the other passengers were taken across to the south bank and placed in Abeli's care. Then the longboat came back and stood by, ready to take the ship in tow if she went aground. Tom stood by the helm, and an anxious silence fell over the little Centaurus, as she ran down on the first meandering bend, where they could see the shape of the bottom through the clear green water. The Arab cavalry column seemed to sense their opportunity and closed up eagerly. Tom cast a glance at them, but although they were now within easy shot, he was too busy to serve the little cannon, and he had to let them come on. The Centaurus swept easily into the bend, and Tom let out his breath with relief. But it was premature. Suddenly she jarred and lurched under their feet as she touched the bottom, then shook herself free and slid on down the green river.
"Oh, close call," Tom breathed.
And then to Sarah at the helm,
"Hold her fair in the green channel."
The next turn came up, and the ship was moving slowly on. The Arabs were half a musket shot back, cantering in formation down the flat, sandy north bank, lances glittering and headcloths blowing in the wind of their ride. The Centaurus hit the sand with her keel and slid to a halt so suddenly that they were almost thrown to the deck. Tom grabbed at the binnacle to steady himself. The Centaurus was grounded solidly.
"Boats away!"
Tom yelled, and every man aboard scrambled down into the longboats. Tom shouted to Sarah, "Keep the helm centred!" Then he left her to it and dropped down into the longboat. The coxswains in the stern of each longboat picked up the ends of the towlines, which were lying ready, and made them fast. Then the rowers, hauling with all their strength, the two boats raced out ahead of the Centaurus until the lines came up hard. They strained at the long sweeps and tried to drag her off the clinging sand. From the south bank, Abeli charged his horse into the water and picked up the end of the long line Sarah tossed to him. He swam his horse back with it, and as his mount lunged out of the river onto the bank, he hitched the end of the line to the team of waiting horses.
"Yaya! Yaya! Haul away!"
He cracked his whip over their backs, and they took up the strain, then threw their full weight against the traces.
The Centaurus grated forward over the gravel, then stuck fast again. On the bank, the Arab horsemen broke into a gallop and swept forward, deploying as they came on. As they drew level with the stranded ship, the first rank wheeled and couched their lances. They struck the river in a wall of white spray and came straight at the men in the longboats. The water reached the bellies of the horses, then rose up to their shoulders. Now the leading horses were swimming, but their riders had the lances poised as they reached the leading longboat and swarmed around it like a pack of sharks around a dead whale. The seamen fired their pistols into the Arabs at close range, then stood up to beat them off with the long sweeps. But the boat was rocking wildly and must soon capsize under the sheer weight of the enemy. On the north bank, the next rank of cavalry wheeled into position for the charge, lining the edge of the sandbar in a solid mass. Abu Bakr was in the centre of the line, his cuirass and spiked helmet shining. He brandished his scimitar and led his horsemen forward at a trot that broke into a canter, then into a wild gallop. Sarah could not leave the wheel. Over the bows she saw the longboat surrounded by struggling masses of horses and men. Tom was standing in the stern with the blue sword in his hand, hacking at the heads of the Arabs in the water. Some of the Arabs were trying to cut the tow rope at the stern, sawing at it with their scimitars. Others were throwing their full weight and that of their steeds onto the gunwale. The boat was canting over until the water poured in over the side. It would soon swamp. Abu Bakr's squadron charged into the river, and even Sarah could see that it would soon be over. She was helpless to intervene. Until now she had not seen Dorian come up from the cabin, Yasmini's shoulder under his armpit to support him. Using her as a crutch, he hobbled painfully to the nearest cannon. He seized the marlin spike to traverse the stubby black barrel. Then he grabbed the smoking slow match out of the sand tub and pressed the end to the touch hole. The weapon crashed back on its tackle, and a storm of grape shot hit the front rank of the charging Arab horsemen just as they reached the water's edge. Clinging to the wooden ship's rail, Yasmini stared across the channel. She saw a 2-ounce ball of lead strike Abu Bakr full in the mouth. His teeth exploded out from between his lips in sparkling chips. Then the ball burst through his jawbone and out through the back of his skull. His spiked helmet was lifted from his head and spun high in the air. The men around him were torn from the saddle, and the ranks buckled and turned back from the water's edge. Dorian stumbled to the next cannon and laid the aim. The horsemen saw the muzzle of the cannon turning towards them and spurred away in panic. The buzzing cloud of grapeshot caught them in enfilade, and a dozen horses went down. In seconds, the ranks were reduced to chaos. They had all seen General Abu Bakr's head shot away, and now Bashir al-Sindh was down too, his horse killed under him. The fight went out of them. They broke and galloped away to avoid the next devastating blast of grapeshot. Yasmini grabbed Dorian's arm as he tottered and almost fell, then led him to the next cannon. As it fired, the Centaurus heeled slightly to the recoil and slid reluctantly over the sand. The Arabs around the longboat saw their comrades on the bank riding away, leaving them unsupported. They turned their horses back towards the shore. "Pull! Pull to burst your guts!" Tom shouted at his crew, and they fell to the oars again. The Centaurus crept forward and touched again. Dorian fired another cannon shot, and as the ship rocked, Abeli lashed the horse team in the traces. Slowly and reluctantly, the Centaurus slid over the bank and floated free in the deep channel beyond. "Back on board!" Tom roared triumphantly. "Get the women and children back on board!" Abeli piled his wives and all their offspring into the longboat as its keel touched the beach. Then he cut the traces of the horses and slapped their rumps to send them galloping into the forest. He ran back and jumped over the gunwale of the boat as the rowers pulled after the Centaurus. The ship was floating away swiftly downstream, and they had to pull hard to catch her. "It is a clear run down to the mouth from here," Abeli told Tom, as he came to where he stood beside the helm. They both looked back at the shattered Arab force on the north bank. They were making no effort to regroup and continue the pursuit. "Stand the men down, Mr. Wilson," said Tom, "and give them all a double tot of rum for their trouble." Alf Wilson touched his cap.
"Begging your pardon, Captain, but you threw the rum barrel overboard. Do you want to put the ship about and go back to fetch it?"
His tone was serious, but his lips twitched. "I think the men will have to wait for it until we reach Good Hope," Tom replied as solemnly. Tom stood at the stern rail as the Centaurus made her offing and the dark mass of the African mainland slowly merged with the gathering night far behind. There was a light step on the deck beside him, and he reached out to pull Sarah in front of him so that her back was pressed against his chest. He hugged her hard to him and reached over her shoulder to kiss her ear. She shuddered deliciously as his beard tickled the back of her neck.
"Dorry is asking for you," she said.
"I will go to him presently," he answered, but made no move to leave her. After a long silence, she asked, "What happens now, Tom?"
"I know not, lass. Good Hope first, and after that, let come what will."
"Well, one thing only is certain. I shall have a little surprise for you once we reach Good Hope."
"Ah?"
He sounded interested.
"What is it?"
"If I tell you, it will be no surprise." She reached behind her, took both his hands and placed them firmly on her stomach. It took him a moment to understand. Then he let out a roar of delighted laughter.
"Jesus love you, Sarah Courtney, I know not what to say."
She knew that that was his most extravagant expression of joy. "Then hold your peace, you great booby, and give me a kiss instead." That is the end of Monsoon by Wilbur Smith.